life, because unless we get zinged out of one of the, that big cluster, the stars in that cluster would be very disruptive to advanced life later. And we can tell by the dynamics of the sun that we were born in a very different location from where we are today. Matter of fact, there's one region in terms of the distance from the center of the galaxy where you get maximum enrichment of heavy elements. There's actually a flow that comes out, and you reach a maximal point here, but we don't live there. We live quite a bit further away, which tells us there must have been a real good kick that got us from that zone out to where we are right now. But this zone is no longer safe for life, so it's important that you get formed in a place where the elements will be appropriately enriched, then you get a kick. And so astronomers are now beginning to piece together exactly how the kick phenomena worked out. Some of the more complex scenarios involve several stars being responsible for the kick, but there is this one paper that puts most of the blame on one really big star that not only gives us an enrichment, but gives us that little zing to speed us out of that cluster into a safe spot in our Milky Way galaxy. Okay, yeah. Well, in the case of our solar system, it's been constant over the last half billion years. Now, previous to that, our mathematics can't tell us whether that's the case. Now, it is unusual for a star to have such a regular oscillation as our sun does, but one reason why it does is that, number one, the oscillation is small. Our oscillation is a lot smaller than what we see for all the stars around us. And so they have a more chaotic up and down movement. Ours tends to be more regular, but it's because it's such a tiny oscillation. Okay, that question is actually raised in the paper, because this scenario, you would say, well, you should be getting a significant drop in diversity every 31 million years, not every 62 million years. Well, what they point out in the paper, and this, you know, if any of you have been to the southern hemisphere, you notice that the density of stars and gas is a lot greater in the northern, in the southern hemisphere than it is in the northern hemisphere. And so what they point out in the paper is that when you make a southward journey, you remain protected through most of that southward journey. It's during the northward trip that you have the greatest exposure. And so when you go north, you don't have as much stuff between you and the center of the galaxy as when you're in the south. So evidently there's a lot of stuff here that helps shield life from the radiation from the core of the galaxy. But in the northward exposure, that shielding is significantly less. In fact, what the paper documents is that compared to the radiation we receive today, when you're at the northernmost extreme, the radiation is 4.6 times greater. But when you're at the southernmost extreme, it's only about a factor of 2 greater. And so that would explain why you're only getting it once during the cycle rather than twice during the cycle. And they actually quote that in the paper as stronger evidence that their theory really does have merit. Yes?
So in terms of spiral arms of the galaxy that we have,
yes. Yes, they do. Right, they do. Well, yeah, and in this particular case, what's more significant than the stars are the dust clouds. And so, again, if you were to take a trip to Australia or South Africa and look up at the night sky, you notice it's rather dense with these gas and dust nebulae compared to what you see in the north. I mean, in the north, we really don't have any spectacular gaseous nebulae to look at. I mean, the ones I've been showing you in the star party, the best we can show you are all in the southern hemisphere. You know, like the Orion Nebula, it's 5 degrees below the equator. Or the other big spectacular one is the Lagoon Nebula. Well, that's, what, 26, 27 degrees below the equator. In terms of what's in the north, there's very little that I can show you. But if we were down in Australia, we could spend the whole night looking at these things. So, but that's just a property of the abnormalities or irregularities of our Milky Way galaxy. So, but right now we're heading towards the danger zone. So what that means is that evidently Jesus Christ is going to resolve the problem of evil and suffering in something significantly less than the next 100 million years. So you can fit that into your eschatology. I don't know whether it works for the premillennial or the amillennialist. I think they're all happy with that time scenario. But we're going to talk today about why that 100 million years is probably way too generous a period of time. Okay? Anything else on this? Yes. Well, I'm married to an English major, so I'm not going to say it's stupid.
He said it takes 63 million years for us to do the cycle. That's
200 light years.
Oh, 200 light years.
Right.
It takes 63 million years for us to bounce up.
Right. So, yeah, we go up 200, then we go down 200. So the total amplitude is about 400 light years from maximum up to maximum down. You have to go from up to down to up to 63 million years, and it takes 250 million years to make one trip around the center of the galaxy. Now, a point that was raised here is we could anticipate that the southern exposure is going to vary a little bit as you go around the center of the galaxy. In fact, the paper makes reference to a lot of studies on the cyclical nature of rodent extinctions and how they're going to fit this into it. So that's a piece of research that they propose for future studies. But, and by the way, these people in no way are trying to comment on creation and evolution. They don't even seem to be interested in that issue, which is why we had to bring on the graduate student that works for Adrian Malott, and he was, oh yeah, we got to talk. He says, my boss, different issue. But what's interesting is his boss, Adrian Malott, has been leading the fight against intelligent design and creationism in the state of Kansas. He's the leader of that. But his students are evangelicals who are passing on some interesting pre-publication information to our office at Reasons to Believe. Now, and this happens all the time, is that the ones most opposed to the creation model are often the ones that are giving the best scientific contributions to support the creation model. Okay. Okay. Well, let's get into our text. The creation text we're looking at right now, for those of you that are new here, we're gradually taking our class through the 25 chapter length or longer creation accounts we find in the Bible. But we're doing it in much more detail than we have the luxury to do through our normal Reasons to Believe channels. We're in Psalm 33 right now, and it's a psalm that talks about the power of God to create and how God creates as he wishes in great detail. And it's a great psalm or creation psalm to go to refute this idea that God has got kind of a hands-off approach to the physical creation, where he kind of sets up the laws of physics, manipulates a few things, but really doesn't get involved in an intimate manner. Psalm 33 strongly refutes that idea, makes the point that God's in control of every detail that we see in the physical creation. And to make that point, in verses 9, 10, and 11, he says, just like I am in complete control of all of creation history, I'm also in complete control of all of human history, which is why we've been taking a few weeks here in the class to look at some texts in the Bible that document the degree to which God controls human history. Now, a question I got last week after class is, you know, we've been talking about Daniel 9, 10, and 11, and part of Daniel 12, where Daniel gets a visit from an angel, and the angel tells him in great detail all the historical events that will take place in what's called the intertestamental period, the period from 400 BC up to the time of Christ. And, you know, we picked that particular passage because a lot of skeptics look at the Bible and say, okay, why is God silent for 400 years? Well, the book of Daniel documents that he was not silent for 400 years. He prophesied through this angel to Daniel in great detail all the events that would take place first in the Persian Empire, then the Greek Empire that would follow it, and the Roman Empire that would succeed the Empire of Alexander and the broken up pieces that were given to the four generals of Alexander the Great. And as you go through those three chapters of Daniel, I mean, the detail is incredible. He even talks about the intrigues of the king of the north and the king of the south, referring to the Egyptian portion of the Greek Empire and the Syrian portion of the Greek Empire, and how the two kings were always conspiring against one another. And that actually talks about a series of kings, and how they're always trying to get one up on one another. Meanwhile, the Romans are kind of watching what's going on and really trying to make sure that neither the Syrians nor the Egyptians get too much power, and they judiciously interfere to such a degree that eventually, as they get stronger and stronger, they wind up taking over both the Assyrians and the Egyptians. And but all this intrigue and political detail, all of it happened exactly as it was prophesied to Daniel. And you heard the mention of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because you might say, well, how have skeptics reacted to this in the past? Well, the way they reacted to it is by saying Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court did not write this prophecy. It was written by a later Daniel, a Daniel that probably lived between 500 and 900 A.D., Well, that doesn't fly anymore because significant portions of the book of Daniel have been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls with a date of 200 B.C. For those scrolls, which means that Daniel that wrote this prophecy actually lived before the events did take place. As we've mentioned, given that it's previous to 200 B.C., the only reasonable author you can tag is Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. Any other person that said, I'm the guy that wrote it, who lived in, say, 400 B.C. or 300 B.C., would have been immediately exposed as a fraud, because it would have been too close to the events that are actually being spoken about. So this really did have to be Daniel. Now, a question I got asked at the very end of the class, after the class was actually over, by the way, I said, Hugh, why haven't you given us the example of all the prophecies that Jesus has fulfilled? And the answer I gave, and I'll give it to all of you, is this. It's hard to get non-Christians to listen to that. I would agree that's a very powerful place to go in Scripture to document that God is in complete control of human history. Because when Jesus of Nazareth came here to earth, he fulfilled 109 different prophecies that were made about him long before he ever came to planet Earth. And some of these prophecies go back, you know, 1,400, 1,500 years. Moses wrote about the coming Messiah in considerable detail. And so it's a great place to go. The problem is that's been spread to such a wide degree that people that you talk to say, oh, I've heard that before. And they really haven't. But it's hard. I've just found in my own experience here in America that it's difficult to get people to listen. Now, when I've been overseas, it's a different matter. When you're in a culture where there hasn't been quite as much exposure to the Christian faith and the person of Jesus, like I found when I was in Mongolia, you talk to people about Jesus and they say, who's he? Hadn't heard of him. Well, almost every American knows, if by no other means than by a swear word, the person of Jesus. And so they're somewhat familiar with the outline of the story. But I think that's the situation we got here in the States, is that people are just kind of jaded and they won't listen. And we found this by going door to door, talking to people about the Christian faith many years ago, that we didn't get very far talking about all the places in the Bible that predicted in advance the details of Jesus' life. But we were able to make some headway with the Daniel portion. That was something they hadn't really been exposed to before. And what you can do is use the Daniel portion as a bridge. You know, once they get interested and excited about what Daniel was able to pull off, now perhaps they'll be willing to listen to all the predictions in the Bible about the life of Jesus. And of course, the exciting thing about these 109 prophecies, they're only a third of the prophecies made about Jesus of Nazareth. There's another 200 plus that are made about what he will do in the future. And incidentally, I've also found, just through my own experience, is that you can get people more excited about something that hasn't happened yet than something that has happened. I mean, you kind of see that when you look at the tabloids in the supermarket, right? That's kind of what sells. Now, what I wanted to share with you this morning is something we found to be most effective of all, is to show people how this book, the Bible, written thousands of years ago, has predicted in great detail events that have taken place in the lives of at least those of us who are past the age of 50. So for you younger ones here, maybe this isn't relevant right now. However, I can say the same thing as I would say about Jesus. There's a lot of prophecies made in the Bible concerning the establishment, the reestablishment of the nation of Israel that have yet to be fulfilled. So what I'm going to talk about this morning, more is stated about the future of the nation of Israel in the Bible than what has already happened in terms of the nation of Israel. But we have personally found this to be an effective tool to get non-Christians to pay attention. Okay. Because what do we hear when you go door to door? The Bible isn't relevant anymore. Let me show you how the Bible is relevant. The Bible is actually speaking about events that have taken place in our lifespan. Okay, with that, and by the way, this is going to be just a few of the highlights. Those of you who are interested in getting the details, we do have a three-hour audio recording of three lectures I gave, 25 years ago here in this church, called Israel, a Modern Miracle. And so that's available from Reasons to Believe. Also available from Reasons to Believe is something that enables you to do your own study. One-page scripture list listing all the scriptures in the Bible that talk about predicting events that will take place in the second rebirth of the nation of Israel. And it was Moses himself who talked about these two rebirths. And we mentioned this last week in Deuteronomy 28 and 29, the last sermon that Moses gave in his life. And in that sermon, he told the Jewish nation that God would judge them twice, but there would be a recovery from each of those judgments. That the first time, they would be judged by being carted off by a single nation to the east. Said, you'll be uprooted from your land as a judgment against your apostasy, and you'll be taken captive to this single powerful nation to the east. But that God would return them from the grip of that nation, which we understand to be the Babylonian Empire, and return to the land of Israel. But once again, they would apostatize, and God would judge them a second time. Now, keep in mind, we're talking something that was put down on written form 1,450 years before the time of Jesus of Nazareth. And what Moses said in that last sermon is, the second time, it will not be a single nation. You'll be taken to all the nations of the world. And the second time won't be a short sojourn. You'll be cast out of the land for many, many generations. And he added this interesting detail. A powerful nation would come from the west and take you in ships to the land of Egypt. And in Egypt, you'll be sold as slaves to all the nations of the world. And you'll be sold in such huge numbers that at the end, they'll be giving you away because they won't be able to find any customers to buy you as slaves. And that's all documented in the history of the Roman Empire. When Titus came in 70 AD, he gathered up millions of Jews, put them in ships, took them to Egypt, and sold them on the Egyptian slave markets throughout the entire Roman Empire and beyond. And he sold so many of these Jewish slaves that at the end, they were literally giving them away. That's how many were sold. Well, Moses said it first, long before the Romans achieved it. And I don't think the Romans are reading the Bible to try to fulfill prophecy. They were just trying to punish these recalcitrant Jews from their perspective. Then we mentioned Luke 21 last week, where Jesus himself predicted that this second dispersal was about to happen. That within a generation after he leaves, he says the Romans would come in and this city of Jerusalem would be destroyed, the temple would be knocked down, and he gave a warning to his followers. He says, when you see the signs I speak of, talking about the Olivet Discourse, when you see these signs beginning to, that will be a warning that the time is at hand. And when you see those signs, leave the land of Israel. Don't stay, leave. And that's exactly what the Christians did. When they saw the Roman forces gathering their strength to put down the Jewish rebellion, they said, it's time for us to leave. And so they scattered throughout the whole of the Roman Empire, And that became kind of the Great Commission start. I mean, all these Christians left Judea and went throughout the Roman Empire spreading the message of salvation through Jesus Christ. And so this is a stimulus to get the Christian message spread throughout the Roman Empire and beyond. But all the unbelieving Jews remained within the land of Israel, and they were the ones that were captured by the Romans, put in ships, sent to Egypt, and sold as slaves throughout the entire world. So that's a review of last week. And one of the things that we see in this description of this dispersal, Hosea makes a statement that it would last 2 days. But it's using a symbolic treatment of the word day, where a day is 1,000 years. He says you'll be without a king 1 day, a second day, and then your king will return. And I've often used this as an argument with young earth creationists as a clear-cut example where days are numbered, and they're not 24-hour days. They're obviously a longer period of time. And so we're talking about this worldwide dispersal literally lasting a couple of 1,000 years. But then they would be returned to the land again. And this is what much of Scripture speaks about, is this second rebirth of the nation of Israel. Now, the second rebirth has connotations with the second coming. Elijah comes twice. Jesus comes twice. And the Jewish nation is born twice. Also, Israel is the only nation in the world that has experienced 2 rebirths. No other nation has. Some have experienced a first rebirth, but not a second. And so this is another way for God to emphasize, I'm in complete control of history. This is not explainable by ordinary human activity. There's something supernatural about the second rebirth. I mentioned last week that long before Israel was formed as a nation, in the 17th centuries and the 18th centuries, Christian scholars and preachers were pointing to the Jews as evidence that God exists and that God is performing miracles, for the simple reason they said there's been no people group that has been dispersed to this degree and has remained an intact people group with an intact language, an intact culture, and an intact religion. It's never happened before. And the only explanation they would say in their sermons, and by the way, a lot of this preaching was going on in early American history. They were making the point, this is proof that God is controlling all the events. In fact, early American preachers said, if God's doing that, then our own nation must be an example of a divine miracle, the way he allowed our nation to be set up and gain its independence from Britain. But they used Israel or the Jews as an example of how God controls human history. So it was long before the nation indeed was born. Now, what is not appreciated by people living today is the degree of desolation that took place upon the land of Israel while the Jews were gone. And that was prophesied over and over again, especially in the book of Isaiah and Jeremiah, that when God would remove them from the land for a second time, the land would become incredibly despoiled. It would be turned into a desert wasteland and would remain as such until the Jews returned to the land. Now, today we look at Israel. It's a beautiful place. It's producing vegetables and fruit that are being exported throughout all of Europe and Asia, but that was not the case just 150 years ago. Now, one piece of documentation I can give you for that is an essay written by Mark Twain. Mark Twain, an atheist, made a month-long trip to the land of Israel and in 1869, and he wrote an essay on his visit, and the essay is called Innocence Abroad, and you can look at it on the web. But this is a short quote he gave out of his essay. And actually, he was kind of writing it as a satire because people encouraged him to go to the beautiful land of God. So he says, okay, I'm an atheist. I'll actually make this trip to this beautiful land of God and see what I see. And so he writes this back saying, it's not quite as beautiful as what you all tell me. He says, quote, there is not a solitary village throughout its whole extent, not for 30 miles in either direction. There are 2 or 3 small clusters of Bedouin tents, but not a single permanent habitation. One may ride 10 miles anywhere hereabouts and not see 10 human beings. Of the beauty of the land, I cannot say enough. Some mountainous desolation and one tree, a grave and ghastly land. So that's what it looked like back in 1869. But it was just 15 years thereafter that the first Jews began to return to the land of Israel. And with their return, they began to transform the land. Okay, now, one of the first things the Bible talks about that will happen just before this nation is born is the places where the Jews would first settle the land. This is in Isaiah chapter 11 and chapter 14. And makes the point that when the Jews are returned by God to the land, the first place they will settle will be Philistia. The next place they're going to settle will be eastern Palestine up to the Jordan River, and then the city of Jerusalem. That would be the settlement pattern in the days before the nation is established. Well, what I have here is a map. Let me see if I got the focus right. That's good enough. And this is a map that shows this initial migration of Jews to the land of Israel. And the first places they settled were the Philistine plain here, basically running from ancient Caesarea down to a town called Ashdod. And what's particularly interesting is that these early Jews retained the Philistine names for the communities that they founded. And to this day, you can see all these. I mean, look on 1 Samuel, and look at all the Philistine cities. Look at a modern map of Israel, and you see it's the same cities. The largest of them being Ashdod, which is located kind of at the southern part of this. And once the Philistine plain began to be settled by these early Jewish migrants, the next place of settlement was this region of Galilee by the river Jordan. And then up into Haifa, which is located right here. And then they began to settle in the Negev, and then large numbers began to settle in the city of Jerusalem. So it's just exactly what you see in Isaiah 11 and 14 in terms of that early settlement. But the numbers weren't large. I mean, before World War II, we're only looking at about 300,000 Jews total living in this region. But as they began to move in, Arabs began to move in as well. So, I mean, keep in mind that, this claim to the land by Arabs and Jews, well, Mark Twain said it, 10 people over a 30-mile journey you might see living in some tents. So before this migration took place, the population of this area was extremely low. The Jews came in first, but once they began to transform things, Arabs also began to move in, particularly into the highland regions. Okay, now we move into Ezekiel 37. And Ezekiel 37, as many of you are aware, is that famous passage about the dry bones. And just a few days ago, I looked at the black and white version of the Nuremberg war trials that featured Spencer Tracy. I mean, they got a new one now that has Alec Baldwin in it. But the old one, the black and white version, what's interesting about that is that they accurately portray how that trial unfolded. And the dramatic part of that trial is when the prosecutors, the American prosecutors, present before the tribunal all these photographs of these large valleys filled with the skeletons of dead Jews, documenting that indeed Hitler and his Nazi compatriots had slaughtered 6.5 million Jews. It says, here are the photographs showing these enormous trenches and ditches and valleys filled with the dry bones. Well, Ezekiel spoke about it 2,600 years ago and gave this vision. Ezekiel was given a vision. He said, what do you see? You know, we can just take a look at the text here. Ezekiel 37, here we go. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. He asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, O sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you'll come to life. I'll attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I'll put teeth in or breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you'll know that I am the Lord. And so I prophesied as I was commanded. Now as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound. The bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and the tendons and the flesh appeared upon them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. And he said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the Lord says, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe these into the slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them, and they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. And he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, referring to the unbelieving Gentile nations, they say, our bones are dried up, and our hope is gone, we are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord, and I will settle you in your own land. Now, what's interesting to go back to that Nuremberg era is that at the Nuremberg trials, these photographs were released, not just to the prosecutors, but to the public. And in newspapers all around the world, they carried photographs of these huge valleys showing all these skeletons piled up, the bones of dead Jews. And it was at that point that you also saw in those same newspapers, Zionism is finished. You say, what is Zionism? That was a Jewish movement in Poland just before the outbreak of World War II to reestablish a nation in the land of Israel. And it was Polish Jews that were moving into the land of Israel, Ukrainian and Polish Jews, that were the initial settlers of this land. And there were, you know, first 100,000, then 200,000, then 300,000, and then World War II broke out. But when these valleys filled with the bones were exposed to the public, that's when these newspapers around the world said Zionism is finished. There will be no nation Israel because of the vast degree of slaughter that has taken place. But the book of Ezekiel makes the point that when the unbelieving Gentiles make that statement, that's the day that God will intervene and establish a nation. It will happen at the time that these people say, your future is finished, it's cut off, there will be no nation Israel. He says that's when it's going to take place. And Isaiah 44 prophesies that the name of this new nation would be Israel, which is interesting because, again, if you go back and look at those old newspapers, the Jews in Israel, as well as the Jews in Eastern Europe, were clamoring for the name Zion. They wanted their nation to be called Zion. And there was a debate taking place in the future parliament of Israel. David Ben-Gurion had kind of a little shadow cabinet, and they're all voting for Zion. And then David Ben-Gurion, as the history books document, stood up in front of what would be the future parliament of Israel and said, we're not going to have a vote. We're going to call it Israel. That settles it. It's the only time David Ben-Gurion ever did that. And years later, he's asked why he did that, and he says, I don't know. I just did. But it got the name Israel. Yes. Yeah, yeah, he lived about 600 years before. Okay, I think I know what your confusion is, because here's the vision that Ezekiel gets about the bones coming to life. But notice it also says in Ezekiel 37 where these living bones are going to come from. Not from the graves, not from these valleys filled with dry bones. They're going to come from all the nations of the world, and they'll come back, and this will be the nation coming to life. So the bones are the symbol for the devastation that took place upon the Jews as a worldwide national group, but he says that nation will come to rest. Yeah, there's been all this slaughter, the bones are dry, but the nation will come to life regardless of what has happened in Russia and Germany, Poland, etc. Will come to life. Now, how you can tie that in more tightly is examine earlier passages in Ezekiel, starting in Ezekiel 34, and how strongly it emphasizes that there's going to be this worldwide return of Jews from the nations of the world to the land of Israel. And as we were talking about Isaiah, talking about the actual places in which that would happen. Okay, now, in the time that remains, I'm going to share something I've never shared in this church before. I mean, some of you have been with our class for 30 years and say, oh, this is all stuff you talked about 25 years ago. But I want to share something I've not talked about ever in this class or this church. And it's a dramatic story of a young woman in the land of Israel at that time. And you'll recognize the name of this woman and the speech that she gave. So I'm just going to pull this. By the way, one really good documentation of the birth of Israel. Those of you who are older will remember this was a best-selling book for an entire year on the New York Times list, called O Jerusalem, written by a couple of European Gentiles, and they document the War of Independence, the 1948 events, and the establishing of Israel. In fact, what's interesting is how the New York Times Book Review reviewed the book before it became a bestseller. Quote, a story as dramatic, as miraculous, as full of wonders as any ever told. That's not a bad statement coming from someone that doesn't believe. So, and then there's another comment. The number one bestseller across the nation, O Jerusalem, is a spellbinding story of one of the major events of our time, the birth of the state of Israel. Let me just read segments from a portion of this text. And we're talking January of 1948. And at that point, it became clear that the UN would act to split the land of Palestine into two states, one for the Palestinian Arabs and one for the Jews. This was going to happen. But the Jews were well aware that when this was going to happen, all the surrounding Arab nations would invade to put an end to the Jewish nation. So they knew there was going to be a war that was going to come. And what the Jewish League had done, the Jewish agency in Tel Aviv, is they sent the treasurer of the Jewish agency to the United States to raise money. His name is Eliezer Kaplan. And so he had just returned in late January from a fundraising trip talking to all the Jewish groups throughout the United States. And, you know, at that time there were 3 million Jews. Actually, I think there's 6 million Jews in the U.S., and so this is the largest Jewish population anywhere in the world. But after a two-month-long fundraising trip, he comes back with his pockets virtually empty, and he explains to David Ben-Gurion and the Jewish agency that the American Jewish community has been tapped out. He says, we've been begging them for 20 years to give us money to establish these commune farms throughout the land of Israel, and they basically have had enough of our coming with an open hand asking for money. And David Ben-Gurion says, well, look, we desperately need money if we're going to be able to defend ourselves against Egypt and Jordan and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and all these other nations. He says, give us the maximum you think we can squeeze out of the Americans. And he said, well, certainly not more than $5 million. And he said, well, if it's not more than $5 million, we will be wiped off the face of the map. It's not going to happen, because all we're going to have are rifles and bullets and grenades, and that's not going to do any good against aircraft and tanks. Well, when David Ben-Gurion heard that report, he said, all right, I'm getting on a plane right now for America. And he said to Kaplan, you're coming with me. We're going to go to America. He says, there's no more important task for me to do. He says, sure, I'm busy with all the preparations to get this nation started, but this is far more important. Without the money, it's not going to happen. We're going to get on a plane. And then we have immediately with David Ben-Gurion making that comment, it says, a quiet female voice interrupted him from the back of the room. And this was a woman who was raised in Ukraine, the daughter of a carpenter in Ukraine, and really not very prominent in the Jewish community at all. But she had spent a little bit of time in Denver about 8 years previous to that. And this is what she said. What you're doing here, I cannot do. However, what you propose to do in the United States, I can do. You stay here, do the important work that only you can do, and let me go to the United States to raise the money. David Ben-Gurion strongly protests and says, no, it won't work unless I go. It's not going to happen. But phenomenally, the rest of the Jewish agency outvoted him and said, no, we need you here. We need to help you raise up the forces that we need and to organize. No one can organize like you can. Send this lady. And so, 2 days later, she got on a plane. And the only baggage she had was a thin spring dress and one $10 bill. You say, why didn't she take more? Well, the rest of her belongings were in Jerusalem, and there was an armed British convoy that would go there once a week. She says, we need the money now. This invasion's going to happen imminently. We need the money right away. So with one dress, and keep in mind, this is early February. She's heading to the United States with one dress, a thin spring dress, and a $10 bill. She gets into New York, and a puzzled customs agent asks her how she intends to support herself when she's in the United States. Because all she had was all she could produce was a $10 bill. And she says, quote, I have family here. Well, truth is, she had no family at all in the United States. When she said, I didn't lie. My family was the Jewish people that lived here. That was my family. So she immediately made contact with some New York Jews, and they said, well, you're here just in time. There's a major conference in Chicago where all the Jewish charitable agencies are gathering together. And but she found out that all the speaking slots had already been filled. And she said, well, I'm going to get on the plane anyway. So she got on the plane, flew to Chicago, showed up at the Council of Jewish Federations, which is this assembly of Jewish charitable groups, and asked for a time slot. And they said, we can't give you one. She says, all I need is 1 minute. And she wasn't sure whether she was going to get that minute or not. But there were a number of New Yorkers there that insisted that she be given her minute. And so she stands up there, and this is after they heard all these speeches to give money for hospitals and synagogues and cultural centers, and she could see that these agencies were all really wearied of all the fundraising going on. Not another hospital, not another synagogue, not another cultural center. And then she went up to the platform after all this discouragement was going on. But as she walked up to the platform, she heard a whisper from the crowd, she looks like a woman of the Bible. Well, all she had was this one dress, so. And then without any text at all, she gave the following speech. I'm going to read you the speech word for word. And it's all happened in just 1 minute. It says, you must believe me when I tell you that I have not come to the United States solely to prevent 700,000 Jews from being wiped off the face of the earth. During these last years, the Jewish people have lost 6 million of their kind, and it would be presumptuous indeed of us to remind the Jews of the world that 700,000 Jews are in danger. That is not the question. If, however, these 700,000 Jews survive, then the Jews of the world will survive with them, and their freedom will be forever assured. But if they did not, then there is little doubt that for centuries there will be no Jewish people, there will be no Jewish nation, and all our hopes will be smashed. In a few months, a Jewish state will exist in Palestine. We shall fight for its birth. That is natural. We shall pay for it with our blood. That is normal. The best among us will fall. That is certain. But what is equally certain is that our morale will not waver, no matter how numerous our invaders may be. Yet those invaders will come with cannon and armor. Against those weapons, sooner or later, our courage will have no meaning, for we will have ceased to exist. She says, I have come to ask you Jews of America for $25 to $30 million to buy the heavy arms we would need to face the invaders' cannon. My friends, we live in a very brief present. When I tell you we need this money immediately, it does not mean next month or in 2 months. It means right now. It is not to you to decide whether we shall continue our struggle or not. We shall fight. The Jewish community of Palestine will never hang out the white flag before the Mufti of Jerusalem. But you can decide one thing, whether the victory will be ours or the Mufti's. Then she sat down. And there was a break. They had coffee. And within 5 minutes, she had raised $1.5 million. And by the end of the evening, she had her $25 million. And she had it in cash. They took out personal loans against their property, their homes, and their businesses, based on the presumption they could go back to their communities and raise that money and replace the loan that they had taken out. But she literally walked out of that room that night with $25 million in guaranteed cash. And then they sent her throughout the rest of the United States, and within the next 2 weeks, she raised another $25 million. And with that $50 million, it turned the tide. And this is what David Ben-Gurion said about Golda Meir. She was the one that went out and raised the money. I saved that to the end, right. The day when history is written, David Ben-Gurion told her, it will be recorded that it was thanks to a Jewish woman that the Jewish state was born. Okay, and she wasn't even 30 years of age. So, and by the way, the general that fought the war with that $50 million, he was 32 years old. So, that was Yadin. Yeah, Yadin was the one that led the 48 war. Now, there were others that were involved under his tutelage. They were even younger than he was. So, it was a bunch of young people that did this. Okay, let me take a couple more minutes in the time that remains to discuss. Yeah, we mentioned this last week just as a teaser for today. One of the things you'll see in Ezekiel 36 is that when the war breaks out that leads to the founding of this new nation of Israel, that there will be a nation to the east out of the ancient land of Edom, and this nation to the east would come in and take possession of all the ancient high places of worship that you find in the Old Testament. And they would come in under the pretense of capturing these lands for the benefit of the people that lives there. But in fact, they would double-cross them and make it part of their nation. And again, those of you that are over the age of 50 will realize this is Jordanian history. At that time, the most powerful army in the Arab world was the Jordan League. And they had the most powerful army, and they came in with their army and captured all these places with the promise that they would turn this into a Palestinian state. But once the war was over, they said, forget it, we're making it part of our nation of Jordan. And so this became part of the nation of Jordan. But what I want to show you is when you go through the Old Testament and look at the location of all the ancient high places of worship, those are those little green crosses you see there, those little green X's. And every single one of them came under Jordanian control. The Jews had control of none of that part of Israel. But if you read Ezekiel 36, it makes the point that this nation to the east would initially possess these ancient high places, but that within a reasonably short period of time, they would come under the control of the Jews to the west. And that's the 67 war. With the 67 war, Jews came under the control of all of those ancient high places of worship. And if you're wondering about the future history of Israel, Ezekiel makes the prediction that these ancient high places of worship will retain under Jewish control from this point forward. They will not be given back under Arab control. So whatever happens in the West Bank is going to happen in such a way that the Jews retain control over all these ancient high places of worship. In that sense, they will not be given back. They might be given back as a place for the Arabs to live, but the Jews would retain control. Now, In the 1 minute that remains, I'll make this final comment, is that the Jews, with that $50 million, made a concerted effort to get one of these ancient high places of worship. And the one they really wanted was the Temple Mount. None other than, I'm trying to think of one of the past prime ministers of Israel, actually took a good chunk of that money and led the attempt. Pardon me? Wasn't Moshe Dayan? Menachem Begin. That's Menachem Begin. Because you had the Haganah, which was the main Jewish army of 30,000 troops, plus a lot of villagers. And then you had a second army, which was led by Menachem Begin, which had 1,100 soldiers. And the Haganah and Menachem Begin's group, called the Ur-Gun, did not get along. In fact, they were fighting one another before the war. And because of the way the war developed, they agreed to unite forces. But Menachem Begin really wanted the Temple Mount. And so he double-crossed the Haganah command and diverted resources to capture the Temple Mount. In fact, he was able to commandeer a couple of scientists to design for him a special bomb that will blow a hole in the old city wall. And it's documented in this book here, O Jerusalem. They tested the device. It worked perfectly. But on the night of the charge, where they're going to break a hole into the old city wall and rescue the Jews there, that was the Haganah's plan. Menachem Begin's plan was to forget about the Jews in the Jewish quarter and grab the Temple Mount. That's what he really wanted to do. And so they set up the charge, and instead of the charge blowing a hole in the old city wall, it went 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And they did an experiment afterwards and one before, and it worked perfectly. It only failed that night when they tried to blow a hole in the old city wall, which prevented the Jews from capturing any of the ancient high places of worship, and had to wait till 1967. I say that because one of the things you're going to see in Ezekiel 36, God makes a clear statement. I'm not doing this because I think the Jews are so great. I'm doing this to get the attention of the peoples of the world. In fact, I'll just take the last minute to close with that statement. I'll get you the verse. Hang on. I got to go through all my little tabs here. Here we go. Ezekiel 36, verse 22. Therefore say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. It is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I'm going to do these things, but for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations where you have gone. I will show the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, the name that you have profaned among them. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the sovereign Lord, when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. And if necessary, God performs miracles against the Jews in order to get this message out to the peoples of the world. Now, I'm going to leave you with a little study question between now and next time. It makes repeated statements here in the book of Ezekiel about how the Jews, during their worldwide dispersal for 2,000 years, profaned the name of the Lord. Question, how did they profane the name of the Lord? Okay. Hopefully that will keep you busy for the next few days in trying to study that. Because I think it's got some real good insights into how we need to communicate our message. Because they did communicate a message, but the message they communicated from God's perspective was one of profanity. From the Jews' perspective, they were shocked. How have we profaned the Lord? Okay, that's enough of a hint. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've spent in your word. We want to thank you for the privilege of being alive at the beginning of the 21st century, when we can accumulate such an overwhelming case for how you, in detail, control every aspect of a creation history, this physical universe in which we live. At the same time, you're in control of every detail and event of human history. And Lord, help us to perceive the wisdom in what you have done, both in geography and in history. Lord, give us insight so we can see what's been hidden from our sight so far as to why you do things the way you do and the purposes you're trying to bring about in the future of mankind and the future of our own lives as individual followers of you. And I pray too, Lord, that you would give us opportunities, even this next week, to share some of the evidence that you've given us with those that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, that they too may have your light penetrate their hearts unto salvation. In Jesus' name, amen.